this core. It is called Rubarva Blade Core. And last year we surveyed the area around the cave and we collected this core. And from experimentation point of view, these two were completely the same. So I think these two were made by one person. I think one person, maybe 70,000 years ago, walked between the cave site and open site. That is very interesting.
Iran has a very long history from the very old times. And all of these sites are very important for the human history.
Signs of early human are not just seen in the Persian Gulf region. The tools made by them are also found in the Persian Gulf islands, like Teshm, that were once connected to the mainland of Persia. Within thousands of years, humans learned new techniques for making more delicate and efficient tools for their expanded activities. The gradual warming of Earth's climate made the vegetation coverage denser, so much so that there was no more need for humans to constantly move in search for food. Consequently, first steps towards sedentism were taken. Sedentism caused populations to gradually increase, and this had a negative impact on food resources. In the process of domestication, humans succeeded in raising some animals unlike their primitive ancestors that were able to produce more milk and wool than their needs. After about 1,000 years of grain farming, our ancestors could find crops that had the capability of being kneaded.
After the domestication of plants and animals, and when man could produce his basic needs, he gradually began to exchange the excess products. This was the beginning of a phenomenon called trade. Later, during late Sedentism and early urbanization, human beings gradually started to choose their own field of specialization. Communications were developed, fixed routes emerged, and trade became global. One of the most important of those routes is today known as the Silk Road. There are two ways to realize the events in the distant past. One to study the historical texts, and the other, findings from archaeological excavations. Some pieces of evidence found through archaeological excavations in the Persian Gulf region prove the existence of marine communications among various civilizations of the ancient world. The formation of Sassanid Empire happened in 224 AD when the Parthian king Ardavan V was defeated by Ardashir I. Always passionate about the development of art and architecture, the Sassanids, in their 400 years of rule, built many structures and cities, among them the port of Siraf, the conquest of Iran by Muslim Arabs, and the eventual end of the Sassanid rule could not stop the increasing growth of Siraf. It remained one of the most important trade ports in the world for hundreds of years. Siraf had become so crowded that 3- and 4-story buildings were erected and corpses were buried in stone graves in the surrounding mountains. Goods reached the Siraf port by big merchant ships and were distributed in the region through a network of roads, bridges, and caravanserais, and finally exchanged in the marketplace. Some of those markets are still as active as they used to be. Pottery, silk, porcelain, spices, perfumes, and precious stones from India, and wood and ivory from Africa were part of the goods exchanged in those marketplaces. In return, Persian Gulf pearls, rose water, perfumes, garments, textiles, precious carpets, minerals, and even bitumen were exported from the ports of the Persian Gulf by skilled Iranian and non-Iranian satyrs to other parts of the world. In the past, the port of Galhad, in today's Oman, was also one of the other major ports of the Persian Sea. In those days, the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, and a significant part of the Indian Ocean were all called the Persian Sea. Rulers of Persia used to govern Galhad and other ports and islands in the sea. The Galhad port was mentioned in the travelogues of Marco Polo and other visiting travelers. Today, similar historical sites can be seen in some parts of East Africa. The structures and buildings and the coasts were made by immigrants from Iran. In the 10th century AD, a person named Ali bin Hassan, along with his family, moved from the city of Shiraz to Siraf and left the port with 7 ships to the east and northeastern parts of Africa, today known as Kenya and Tanzania, and established a new government there. The Shirazian people were originally Persian. Their distinctive characteristic? Interaction with other people and nations with great respect for their beliefs. The Persian king, Cyrus the Great, founded the Achaemenid Empire in the 6th century BC. Is well recognized for his achievements in human rights, politics, military strategy, as well as influence on both Eastern and Western civilizations. Signs of moral characteristics can be seen in the remains of the Achaemenid relics. The way Achaemenid soldiers treated the representatives of affiliated nations are clearly visible there. The Shirazian people treated native East Africans and other African civilizations with respect and succeeded in changing the areas under their rule into thriving business centers. This went on until certain events changed the situation in the world during that period. Another thriving port of ancient times was Harira, an ancient 8th century city located in what is now called Kish Island in Iran. In 976 AD, the port of Siraf was devastated by a massive earthquake. As the result, the port of Harira gradually became the main trade center in the Persian Sea. During this period, the Portuguese began to occupy islands and shores of the Persian Gulf. The Iranian Safavid government had become embroiled in a long conflict with the Ottoman Empire to prevent them from entering the Persian territory. The Portuguese took advantage of the opportunity and constructed their own fortresses in the region. Albuquerque believed that the island of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf was one of the world's 3 strategic locations. To him, having control over the island would result in the domination of global maritime trade. Thus, he built a strong fortress there. since the Hormuz Island is geologically a salt dome lacking fresh water, Albuquerque built a supply fort to be able to store this vital liquid. He also stockpiled ammunition and necessary supplies for his troops there. Imam Quli Khan, the ruler of Fars province at the time of Shah Abbas Safavi, took his army to the coasts of the Persian Gulf. With the permission of Iran's government, the Dutch established many business offices in Persian Gulf ports. Later on, they gradually closed their offices and moved to Hark Island, where they started to build castles and deploy heavy weapons. Then Emir of Hark, Mir Mahna, saw the invasion and began to fight for the liberation of his land. At the age of 18 and during the rule of his father over the region, Mir Mahna also took part in the liberation of Bahrain and defeat of the occupying Huala Arabs. But this time he took command of the battle himself. Today, there are some people of the Mir Mahna clan still living in the northern coasts of the Persian Gulf. Even now, they preserve their old traditions, such as the important role of the patriarch in addressing the problems and spiritual needs of family members. People living on the edge of the Persian Gulf were very welcoming toward the Dutch in the beginning. But experiencing their tyrannical behavior, they all joined Mir Mahna to free their lands. After 15 years of struggle, Mir Mahna and his followers succeeded in driving the Dutch out of the Persian Gulf and finally raised their waving tribal flag over the Hark Island.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most beneficent. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, my dear brothers and sisters. And lovely listeners, thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. It's an honor and a pleasure, as always, to be with you guys today, where we're going to talk about, as usual, a short little story regarding a gardener, a dude who planted a rose. I loved his rose so very much. It kind of reminds me of Little Prince. With a cute little moral of the story to it. So, without further ado, let's listen to the story real quick, and we're going to be right back, so stay with us.
The title of today's story is The Rose Within. A certain man planted a rose and watered it faithfully, and before it blossomed, he examined it. He saw the bud that would soon blossom, but noticed thorns upon the stem, and he thought, how can any beautiful flower come from a plant burdened with so many sharp thorns? Saddened by this thought, he neglected to water the rose, and just before it was ready to bloom, it died. So it is with many people. Within every soul there is a rose. The godlike qualities planted in us at birth grew amid the thorns of our faults. Many of us look at ourselves and see only the thorns, the defects. We despair, thinking that nothing good can possibly come from us. We neglect to water the good within us. And eventually, it dies. We never realize our potential. Some people do not see the rose within themselves. Someone else must show it to them. One of the greatest gifts a person can possess is to be able to reach past the thorns of another and find the rose within them.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Right, so in life, we will, as human beings, constantly be in a state of limbo regarding whether we are good enough. Every human being feels it. But what's important, however, like every other aspect of life, is to create a balance, an equilibrium, a yin and yang regarding this matter. And Islam, as always, comes to the rescue and shows us the best way to establish that yin and yang for ourselves, as it does create balance in every other facet of our life. That's the whole objective of Islam. One could think, I can live my life without religion. I can try to be physically healthy, mentally healthy, and psychologically healthy. That's wonderful. Good on you for trying. But at the end of the day, as human beings, we often fail to create that perfect balance. And it's from my understanding and personal experience in life throughout these 20-something years that I've been living on God's green earth, that Allah, who knows me the best, knows what I need the best, and He can create the best balance for me. So that's the objective of Islam in a nutshell. For us to be ummatan wasata, something in the middle, the medium society. And Allah praises us for that. So basically, what is the yin and yang we can create for ourselves regarding the feeling that, am I ever going to be good enough, right? As human beings, we look at ourselves and we are given the choice to either focus on our thorns, focus on our spikes, focus on the fact that if anyone touches us, we're going to prick their fingers and make them bleed and hurt them. Or we can focus on the fact that, hey, look how beautiful I am. Look how, and by beauty, I don't just mean outer beauty. Everyone can be beautiful on the outside. But because Allah has created us fi ahsan taqweem, in the best manner, what's really important is to develop that inner beauty that makes us radiate that aromatic fragrance that captivates the hearts, right? That comes from the inside. Or we can focus on that. We can focus on how everyone yearns to have a rose because it's so beautiful. It can give so much happiness and joy. It can bring so much liveliness into a room, whatever room it's placed in, right? And I think the closest concept I could think of regarding this matter is the concept of khawf and raja that exists within our religion. And Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, I find, has emphasized on it more than any. Khawf and Raja basically means to have fear that, will Allah forgive my sins? Have I been the best Muslim, the best servant that I possibly could? Have I done enough to please my Lord, to be a good human being, to bring benefit and value to the places, the spaces I occupy, and to those around me? Have I been successful in touching their hearts and inspiring them to become better? And by becoming better, I mean getting closer to Allah. And I can only do that through my righteous actions. If I haven't made myself upright and upon the straight path, no matter how much I talk about Allah, people are going to see right through me. And they're going to be like, well, why don't you practice what you preach, right? And on the other hand, I have Raja. I have hope that no matter, even if I have sinned, equivalent to all the sins of history, these are the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen, even if my sins have reached the skies and scraped the clouds, even if my sins are equivalent to all the grains of sand and all the drops of water, Allah's mercy, Allah's limitless forgiveness is way, 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 way more than all the sins of all the worlds. And that should give me hope. That should give me the strength to carry on. If I manage to focus on the goodness I can develop within myself through the limitless help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through that great almighty power that I choose to anchor myself on, ground myself with, then the sky is the limit. There's absolutely nothing I can't do once I keep that in mind. If I manage to create that balance within myself, that the only thing holding me down, weighing me down, is my sins, and the only thing I need to rely on, that beauty that I get is from the limitless source of beauty itself, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. My thorns are my sins, and my pros and my asset is my Allah. And life is perfect. Thank you so very much for being with me on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
The question of the day actually is the continuation of the question that was posed in our last show. So that's why we try to, inshallah ta'ala, continue to talk about and discuss that question again. And what was the question? The question was, what is a good plan or the best plan? What do you recommend for the rest of the days and months that we have in year to be benefited from the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan? So we have only one golden month where Allah's blessings and bounties are showered on his beliefs, on his creatures. Now, how can we actually store these positive energy for the rest of the year? This was the question, and Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic scholar, actually touched upon this issue to some extent, but we left the whole answer to be given and presented to you today. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome. We are listening to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, if we want to continue acting upon what we gain in the holy month of Ramadan, first we need to know what we can gain during this holy month. I mentioned that according to the verse of chapter Baqarah, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, reaching taqwa and God-weariness is the main purpose for fasting. And a narration from the Holy Prophet reads that the best action during the holy month of Ramadan is to be away from maharim Allah, the forbidden actions. Now, there are some other spiritual things that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan, and then we can have a program for keeping them after the holy month of Ramadan. One of them is the fact that through fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, we are able to be much more careful about the day of judgment. Mm-hmm. In one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, وَذْكُرُوا بِجُوعِكُمْ وَعَطَشِكُمْ فِي جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَعَطَشَ. So as people being involved during the year in worldly affairs, we may not think about the Day of Judgment a lot, which is very unfortunate. But during the Holy Month of Ramadan, one of the spiritual gains is that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, through your hunger and thirst, remember your thirst and hunger on the Day of Judgment. So this is another spiritual lesson that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan.
Very true.
Doing ihsan or benevolence. We know that the holy month of Ramadan is the month of paying charity and sadaqah. There are, many narrations about the virtues of giving ihsan, charity, sadaqah during the holy month of Ramadan. We can practice it during the holy month of Ramadan. It can become a habit for us, and then we can continue acting upon that after the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is taking benefit from the dawns, from the sahar during the holy month of Ramadan. Let me share sentences mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He says that in this busy world, if we are not able to take benefit from the time of Sahar or Dawn, we do not have any other time to have a privacy for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our heart, with our God. There is no other time. We are busy. In 24 hours, a couple of hours we are sleeping, in the times that we are awake, every person has a worldly, some worldly affairs. So Ayatollah Khamenei continues to say that in the past we had some opportunities to have such free time, but today this is the force of the time. We have some new phenomena which were not there in the past. So according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the only time that we can have a privacy for ourselves and for our hearts between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is during Sahar or Dawn. Now, because of the fact that at least, many Muslims, they get awake before dawn to eat suhoor, again, it can become a habit for the believers to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So taking benefit from this time is a gracious blessing of the holy month of Ramadan. But many people, unfortunately, from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they continue to get awake from, after Adhan al-Sawab to say the morning prayer. But it would be great if people can practice that during the holy month of Ramadan. And
to wake up before Adhan.
Exactly, and to make it into a habit, doing tahajjud, night vigil. There are many stories, many statements by the great scholars about the virtues of night vigil. Maybe 10 minutes before Fajr, Adhan, it would be great. And gradually people can increase the time, inshallah. So it is one of the great blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. The next point is reciting the Quran. Again, many Muslims, they do that during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that many people are able, through the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to do a khatb, to recite one juz every day, so that at the end of the month, they are able to read and recite the whole noble book of Quran. For 30 days, we are practicing that. Again, we can turn it and change it into a habit. Not one juz every day, at least 50 verses, according to some narrations. If not able, one page, two pages. We need to have this connection to the noble book of Quran. Ikhlas or sincerity is another spiritual...
So the next recommendation was to have this constant relation with the Holy Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as it has been recommended to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran per day,
mm-hmm.
at least in other days. While in the holy month of Ramadan, we should not suffice with even one juz of it.
It depends. If people have the time, we have about the scholars. For the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, for the Prophet, we have in the narrations that they used to, do the khatm of the Quran several times during the holy month of Ramadan. We have the same stories about some of the great scholars. But maybe we can say, of course, this isn't a recommended act, but maybe the minimum which is expected from the believers is to do at least one khatm during the holy month of Ramadan and continue to have this connection with this noble book after the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned again, many people, unfortunately, right from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they forget about everything. They forget about paying charity, about... Mm-hmm. Salatul Layl, about reciting the Quran, and so on and so forth.
But Sheikh, this recitation of the Quran is very, this is what I understood from the actually text of Hadith, from the tongue of the Hadith, or the language of the Hadith, that a person who does not recite 50 verses of the day will be included in the circle of ignorance, if I'm not mistaken, and the Hadith goes well here. So we have to take refuge to God subhanahu wa ta'ala for this. At least we need to oblige ourselves to recite Quran. As for tahajjud, I have also another point to mention. Is it enough, Shaykh, just to at least practice tahajjud with two rak'ahs, at least slowly, slowly, but later on, inshallah, it will become a habit for us and we shall perform the whole thing, with 11 rak'ahs?
Yeah, when it comes to tahajjud, the great scholars, they say that first of all, it should be done in a gradual way, because we have seen some people that they begin by, for example, doing that for 1 hour or half an hour, but after 1 month, they get tired and exhausted, and they stop doing that altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that it should be gradual. For the first step, people may do that before going to sleep after, Shari midnight. I mean, naturally between 11, 12 p.m., it is the beginning of Shari midnight, and people can read the Salatul Layl from that time onwards, but it's better to be said before Adhan stop. So in the first step, some people may do that if they are not able to be to get up before Fajr prayer. But then, as you mentioned, the next step would be just waking up. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe for 1 week or 2 weeks, you just try and practice to be able to wake up.
Very true.
Next, just to make a wudu. I mean, it's been mentioned by some of the scholars. Next, just reading and saying two rak'ah prayer, and gradually you would increase that into 11 rak'ahs. And it's very important to be done gradually and not force our heart to do the recommended action that we are not, inclined toward that. If it is done gradually, we will feel that interest to doing that more and more.
So waking up at that time before Adhan by itself is very important.
Exactly.
And breathing in that in the atmosphere, in the environment actually by itself is actually influential in the human beings, but better to recite two rak'ahs, much more better to recite the whole thing, 11 rak'ahs.
Yes. There are stories, quoted from the great scholars, and they are astonishing, good for the people who are able to practice that. And many scholars of Irfan, they say that without tahajjud, you cannot continue treading the path of spirituality.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Actually, up until now, you have given us and told us some recommendations on how to keep our connections with the whole month of Ramadan. One, with regard to tahajjud and staying awake before the Fajr, and second, having a constant program for recitation of the Holy Quran, and now we are listening to the rest.
You know, there are many things to learn from the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned, the best action is to be away from forbidden acts, reciting the Quran, doing tahajjud, ikhlas and sincerity is one of the blessings of fasting, repentance, tawbah, increasing the willpower. All these are the great, effects and benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. But how we are able to keep doing them after the holy month of Ramadan? We have a concept in Islamic spirituality based on the narrations, and that is the concept of musharata, muraqaba, and muhasabatun nafs. I need to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that we have make reciting the Quran a habit for us during the holy month of Ramadan. I'm talking about a recommended act. You can do that about being away, for example, from backbiting or from telling lies or any other forbidden action. This is an example. We can think of other examples as well.
True.
So after the holy month of Ramadan, every day early in the morning, we do musharata. We say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will recite 50 verses of the Noble Book of Quran.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, we do muraqaba. We think about that promise. We do that, and every night before going to sleep, we do muhasabah. We think about our actions, whether I was able to act upon that promise, which could be reciting the Quran or being away from backbiting, and so on and so forth. So if we do that, on a daily basis, gradually we'll see great effects. And it could be confirmed and guaranteed by a nazr, a vow, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I'm a person suffering from backbiting, during the holy month of Ramadan, I practice that, but then I need a long program after the holy month of Ramadan. After the morning prayer, I say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will not backbite at all, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If I do that, I make a vow that for each backbiting, for example, I will fast for 1 day, or for example, I will pay $10 in charity. During the day, I will do muraqaba. At night, when I think about our actions, for example, I come to see that I have backbitten, for example, once. So I need to fast the following day because of the nab.
Right.
It would be pretty difficult. So the next day, I would be more careful about my actions.
Right.
Of course, the vow should be in a moderate way. For example, I shouldn't say that I will fast for 2 months if I backbite once, or I will pay $10 in charity. It should be something in a moderate way. So gradually this program of musharata, muraqaba, muhasaba will help us,
inshallah, to
keep the blessings of the Holy Month of Ramadan.
Are we done with this question, Sheikh?
Yes.
One more thing I think is good to be added to this, and inshallah, finalize the discussion. I think we have some days in a month, except the Holy Month of Ramadan, that are recommended to be fasting on those days. Again,
exactly.
I think if we keep fasting, for example, 3 days a month,
that's
or at least
true.
1 day per month, it is also another good connection with this Holy Month.
Yes.
Thank you, dear Sheikh, for your answers and these scholarly answers to the questions and enlightening answers which were given to the questions by you. And you respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
Aperture. Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold? Or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold, and in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
Kingai.
King or gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
Il oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines. Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name. And he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500. Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a thousand year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Byzant survived for 1,000 years. The Byzant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square, so they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold.